Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 13 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. As I mentioned last week, listeners will now have the opportunity to ask questions to upcoming guests. Next week will be an all rugby week, as I will be chatting with Keir Wenham-Flat, strength and conditioning coach for Argentina's Rugby Union Club, which recently played in the Rugby World Cup, and Dan Howells, the strength and conditioning coach for England Rugby Sevens. If you have any questions for them, send me a tweet at historicperform or email me at historicperformance@gmail.com. After a really great previous episode, I decided to bring on another soccer coach. His name is Hugo Langton. He owns a successful opposition scouting company and formerly was a first team coach with Bromley Football Club, who played last season in the National League South and was promoted to the National League. In today's episode, we cover opposition scout reports, the challenges of working with semi-professional footballers, tactical periodization, and his thoughts on the importance of coaches understanding the physical demands of the game. Let's get this episode started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm excited to have actually the second non-sports scientist and fitness coach here with me. Before, we had talked to Paul Heckingbottom from Barnsley Football Club. And today I have Hugo Langton. He formerly was a coach, Bromley FC, and helped them gain promotion to the National League. So really excited to hear about his thoughts, especially working with that level of English football. And Hugo, how are you?
Very well, James. Very pleased to be here.
Really pleased that you're here with me. I think this is going to be a little bit of a refreshing podcast. We're going to be talking about opposition scouting reports. We're going to be talking about a little bit about your ideas in terms of creating a winning culture and a little bit about tactical periodization. Now, that's a bit of a heavy topic. We can probably be here for 2 or 3 days talking about it, but
you're not wrong.
Yeah, we're gonna hit it as much as possible here, at least, you know, the basics. So let's start off with opposition scouting reporting, because you have a webinar coming up on December 7th. I'll make sure to link it when I publish the podcast, but if you can give us just a little information about it.
Yeah, sure. A little bit of background is some years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago, I created a course because I needed people to go and watch games for me, but I needed them to understand what I was looking for and why. So I actually ran a course somewhere in Southeast London where I was quite overwhelmed. About 15, 20 people turned up to it, and we went through the course, and as a result, some of them sort of became opposition scouts for me at the clubs I was at the time. And it's just kind of grown from there. And so it's leading up now to the 7th of December. Like you say, I've got a webinar. It's around about an hour and a half long. And in it, I try to get the point across about when you go to watch a team play, what do you look for and why, and how to document it in a format that's presentable. Basically, how do you beat the other team? And I currently have got a network around England and of sort of some very, very good scouts. And I rent them out to clubs all around the country at all different levels, from professional leagues into semi-professional leagues.
So this webinar, what type of experience do you need to be part of it, if any? And also, what exactly are you going to be learning from it?
Well, do you know, people with all backgrounds come on my course. Some people are current coaches or they're coaches out of work. I get players reaching into their careers. I also get guys that just love football. One of my most senior scouts, as it were, is a retired police officer, you know, with no kind of coaching or playing backgrounds as such. So the course is really for anybody. And a lot of people who come on the course don't necessarily complete the course with the attitude that they want to be an opposition scout. A lot of people just come on the course because they want to talk about football and perhaps learn something new and look at the game from a different perspective. So within the course itself, sort of a brief overview would be obviously how do you document everything and the key points within the documentation of it. So that would perhaps be things like, you know, teams attacking trends, defending trends, transitions of play, strengths, weaknesses, set pieces, sort of attitudes, and that would include that of the manager, and also a breakdown of players. We back up these reports with video evidence, so the scouts will video all set plays for and against, but they'll also video things like if a team's got a long throw, and they'll also video examples of a team's defensive shape, and that's both in transition and also when they're set up to perhaps to deal with a goal kick. Now, the reason that I ask for the scouts to provide video evidence is for a number of reasons. So it might be that I might see something different within the video footage than them that's important to me and my team. Secondly, it means that I can show players, for example, if a team's got a dangerous corner kick routine, that it's easier to show them the video rather than to try and recreate it or warn them on the training ground beforehand. So in general, that's really kind of what we're looking. Obviously, it's a little bit more in depth than that. Within the course, I provide photographic scenarios, and just provoke the thoughts of the attendees.
It sounds like a fairly comprehensive course. After this happens, those who are interested in possibly continuing it and have a fairly good understanding, then you'll help them, at least in England, help them find a club that they can do opposition scouting?
Yeah, what happens is at the end of the course, those that wish to try and have a go, I send them a template and they'll go to a game and they'll write a report. They'll send the report in to me and I will work with them to bring it up to the standard that I'm looking for. I do get some guys that are actually existing scouts as well. So with them, it's just a little bit of sort of tinkering of the way that they report to suit, my model, as it were. Then after that, I'm looking at, getting these guys work. So I don't give them to clubs as such. So I have regular clients, but also particularly in cup competitions in England, like in the FA Cup, or for example, I get a lot of semi-professional teams will contact us and hire a scout to go and watch a team because it's prize money. So I don't charge a great deal of money to hire a scout. But in the FA Cup, for example, so if you win one of the early rounds, it's worth anything between a few thousand pounds, anything up to £20,000-£25,000 for a victory. So, and that's a lot of money for smaller semi-professional non-league teams, or even at the lower end of the football league.
No, and I didn't even know that was the amount of money that you could make winning some of those earlier rounds. I can now see why people would want your services, especially at the semi-professional level.
If you look, an example would be in England at the moment, there's a lot of attention on a club called Salford City that are owned by a bunch of ex-Man United players, sort of Gary Neville, Phil Neville, Paul Scholes. But they're actually what's called a Step 3 non-league team. So they would have played 4 games to get to the first round of the FA Cup. So the first round is when the lower end professional teams come in, and round 3 is when the Premier League teams would come in, for example. So Salford City will have earned somewhere just in prize money of winning 4 games, because they actually got to the second round now. They would have earned somewhere in the region of £40,000 to £50,000. And that's without other sponsorship deals and TV money they would have got. So it's worth probably double that. It's probably worth £80,000 to them.
Wow, to give you an idea. That's an incredible amount of money, especially at that level. I had no clue.
There you go.
Well, I guess that's what happens since I'm American and don't know in terms of the lower leagues of
prize money for winning games in the FA Cup is a big deal to non-league and semi-professional football teams here. Sometimes there's some clubs in the past that I'm aware of that have got to the FA Cup third round and they've earned in the region of £250,000. And that sets them up for the next 2, 3, 4 years. So it can be kind of almost club changing, sort of life changing, whatever you want to call it.
I think that's a great transition to talk about a little bit about Bromley and your time there. You helped them. You helped them get promoted to the National League. So, just for our American viewers, can you give them a little bit of background in terms of National League North and South, and then the National League and where it sits within English football?
Of course, yeah. You have the obviously at the top of the game, you have the Premiership. Then you have the Championship. Then there's League One and League Two. They're the four sort of so-called professional leagues. Then below that, you've got the National League itself, which is also more or less a full-time league. And what I mean by full-time is that the players will, that's their sole job. They won't have any other jobs. So they'll go in and train in the daytimes. So the majority of the National League is are 80% probably full-time. Then below that, it's split to North and South, where the majority will be part-time. There's one or two that will be full-time, depending if they've got the financial backing. So Bromley were in the South, and I was there for 2 years. In the first year, we finished third in the playoffs and unfortunately lost the playoffs. But then the following year, we won the league and were promoted into the National League. So they were great times. I had a great 2 years there. And the club are actually doing very well at the moment in the National League itself.
What was the club structure like? It's a semi-professional club. So what type of support staff would you have? And how often would you get to see the players?
Well, at Bromley, we had unusually quite a big support staff, and everybody contributed to the cause. And that's probably a huge reason as to why we won the league. So there was the manager, assistant manager, two coaches, a goalkeeping coach, a physio, and a fitness coach or sports scientist. Then on top of that, you'd have volunteers who do analysis, things like that. So, but they weren't sort of really around the training ground and things like that. But we had quite a large support staff. In terms of contact with the players, we'd play on a Saturday. And on a Tuesday night, we'd either have a game or we would train, and then we'd train again on a Thursday night, and then you play again on a Saturday. So the contact time was fairly minimal. And at times, in terms of the training ground, we perhaps would only have a Thursday night, which would be an hour and a half, by which time the players are also kind of in recovery mode from the Tuesday night to get them fresh for Saturday. So contact time could be fairly minimal. These guys have jobs as well, so you have to take into consideration that they may have been up scaffold poles or building walls all day long, or some of them are personal trainers, and you have to take that into account as well. So very interesting scenario, quite testing, but very enjoyable as well.
Yeah, it does sound very interesting, and it's a different aspect because prior to this in the podcast, I've had most people that have worked in the professional ranks, so they haven't had to deal with someone who may necessarily be a personal trainer or construction worker and then is playing this because mainly they love the sport. It's a way for them to make a little extra money too, but also be involved in a sport that they love.
That's right. But also the higher end of semi-professional football in England is a very, very high standard. It's a very competitive sport here in terms of you've got 92 league clubs, then you go into the non-leagues. And unfortunately, there isn't room for everybody. And what you find is because at the top of the game, they perhaps recruit more from abroad, which means English players get pushed down the pyramid. And it has a knock-on effect, and certainly into the higher end of non-league, where you get some fantastic players. And I've worked with players that have played in the Premiership, the Championship. I've had players that have played international football, all sorts. So it's a very, very, very high standard. But in terms of a club's approach to whether they're full-time or part-time, depends mostly, obviously, on the resources available. So at Bromley, for the 2 years I was there, we were part-time. I was there in part at the beginning of the transition to full-time, and having that extra time with the players made a huge, huge difference. You get more work done with them, and you could look after them better because they weren't necessarily up scaffold poles or driving taxis or whatever, throughout the night.
Yeah, and I'm sure that definitely helped in terms of making your job slightly easier.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and but it gives you more time to work with the players, not just tactically, but also technically. And when you only have them perhaps on a Thursday night because you've played Saturday, Tuesday, you know, you're very aware of the players' individual needs in terms of making sure that they're fresh for the Saturday. And so, you know, you have to take into consideration that. But I believe science has proven that it takes the body 3 days to recover from a game of football or soccer, as you call it in America. And on day two, my understanding is that that's when the body's at its tiredest because it's repairing itself. Now, that's then, if you think about it, you've played Saturday, you've played Tuesday, then you've got them in 48 hours later. So that's in day two. And then you've got your eye on the fact, well, they've got a game 48 hours later. So to ensure that they're fresh, you've got to, I believe you've got to work quite cleverly.
Yeah, and I think one thing that should be highlighted also, there's a accumulating factor into that. So obviously, if you have a weekend game and then I believe it was a Saturday and Tuesday game you mentioned.
Yeah, you know, and I'll be honest with you, in the past, I've worked at clubs where it's very hard, but, you know, to ensure that the manager, for example, or, you know, the decision maker understands this sort of aspect of the game. Because what generally tends to happen throughout semi-professional football in England is that players are rushed back from injury too quickly. They're not allowed also to recover properly between games, and then they're overloaded physically in training. And as a result, players spend more time injured than they would do on the pitch. And you see it quite a lot throughout semi-professional football. A team might be desperate for a win, and a key player hasn't played for 3 weeks because he's been injured. He then trains on the Thursday, declares himself fit, and starts on the Saturday. And then, you know, if he gets through the game, then fair play. But it's only a matter of time, really, until he's sitting up in the stand again with an injury. So they're kind of one of the biggest battles that, you know, you find in non-league, is ensuring that players are fresh and fit and ready to go. You know, and that's largely down, in my opinion, just to sort of naivety, perhaps, towards the physical side of football and players' bodies and recovery times.
Part of one of your previous webinars featured two men from Spain, one actually who was on the podcast, and his you probably have heard his episode by now. His name is Manuel Lapuente Sagarra. And he's just specifically talking about tactical periodization.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And I actually, it wasn't a webinar. He came with his colleague, who's a coach at Espanyol, over, and they delivered a course for 1 day on tactical periodization in London. And that was a real privilege. And Manuel's a very, very clever guy. I'm glad that you've interviewed him.
Yeah, we talked there. He just specifically talked about tactical periodization, but I kind of want to talk about it. How you manage to implement that system that methodology, because it's not a system, that methodology, that theoretical framework within a non-league club like Bromley.
It was a real challenge because you have to take, as we've discussed and highlighted already, and I'm sure Manuel spoke in depth about from his own experiences within full-time football, within non-league football, semi-professional football, it's harder to periodize, as it were. It really is kind of week to week because there's various things that influence it, and that might be that 1 week you have a midweek game, another week you won't. You may not be able to get on a training pitch. You might have to take the weather into consideration. Might be the fact that a player has to work late and can't make training. So there's a lot of different things to take into account, but things that I think that you can certainly pinpoint within your own team is looking at players' injury histories, for example, and take into consideration what they do within their other job. So for example, there's been players in the past that it's apparent to me that were unable to play 3 games in 7 days. They couldn't play Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday because it overloaded their bodies too much. And as I said, that was easier to pinpoint because of a player's history with injury, and it might have been the same thing, which is usually lower back or hamstring. And then the key issue then was convincing the manager that this player shouldn't play, or you get games certainly in Christmas and Easter times where you play twice in 3 days, and you know, if you might win the first game, the manager might be keen not to make changes for the second game, but then you struggle in the second game because players are tired. Whereas the other team might have rotated their squad, but you haven't, and then as a result, you probably don't get the positive result that you want. I also think that within semi-professional football, you need to take into account, as I said before, the players. What have they done during the day? You know, it's really important, but also because after you spend some time with players, a period of time with players, you start to understand them. And like, I can turn on the television and watch a game with a player that I've worked with in the past with, and I know it's him because I can just tell by his body movements, as it were. But so little things like if you're forward, your movements are perhaps going to be more explosive in terms of you know, going after a ball, and so it'd be very different to a defender. And I think it's highlighted, for example, with Daniel Sturridge at Liverpool, whereby you know, he's had a series of injury problems because he hasn't been allowed the time to recover that his body perhaps needed. And as a result, you know, when he's hurried back, his body's broke down again. So in terms of the answer to your question, it's something that you have to consider from a week-to-week basis. And it's actually without trying to, in any way, sound, trying to avoid giving a straightforward answer. It's one that you just can't. But, you know, in terms of the tactical side of the periodization, it's very easier when you're the team like at Bromley, where we had more than one coach, where you can break it down into sub-principles and sub-sub-principles. So whether you're working with the team, a unit, or the group. So quite often that's how we'd run training, that, you know, perhaps I'd take the defence for a while, someone else would take the midfield, and someone else would take the forwards. We work on specific things within our principles of play alongside what we believe are the correct timings in terms of... you know, so they might play for 90 seconds and they have 2 minutes off, 90 seconds, 2 minutes off. So you're not overloading the body, for example. And then we'd put them all together at the end to ensure that perhaps always at a game intensity, but to make sure that there was enough breaks in play where you're perhaps working on those principles of play, but also with one eye on how your next opponent plays. So... and you've got to try and cram all this into quite a short space of time. So, as you can imagine, huge, huge, huge challenge. And one personally that I love.
Just for those that may not necessarily know what the whole idea behind tactical periodization, you mentioned sub-principles and then sub-sub-principles. What are those?
Well, tactical periodization itself is always, so you're always working with... your training is always based on your team's model of play, whether it be attacking play, defensive play, or the transitions between the two. So transition from attack to defence and from defence to attack. So they're the four sort of constant things that happen within football. So your principle, you know, you could have a principle of, you like to get the ball out wide, for example. So you could then work with the sub-principle would then be, you'd be working with a unit of players. So that match might be the back four and it might be the midfield four, or it might be the front two. So you're looking at a unit which is more than one player. So if you're looking at getting the ball wide, then you could work with your back four and that, you know, but how perhaps playing out, how do they split and the sort of passes they might play. Then obviously the same with the midfield four. So yeah, that's a unit. Was a sub principle is working with just one player on something specific about his game. So if it's a wide player, it might be his crossing, his types of crossing, depending on where he is in the pitch, for example. But that again will come into your own principles of play. You know, so it's whether you like your wingers to get the ball quite deep and run an attack 1v1, get to the byline, or do you want them to put in an early cross, you know, to catch a team off guard? So that's how you'd break down tactical periodization in sort of in a nutshell, for me anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a really great overview of it. And since we have been talking about the physical, I think it's important to highlight that in order to make sure that you're having the players meet the physical demands of their specific role, the person, whether it be the sports scientist or the fitness coach, and this is where communication is key, should know the manager's tactical philosophy and the way that the roles of each specific player on the pitch. Is that correct?
Again, it will vary from club to club, you know. You know, the fitness coach, for example, at Bromley wouldn't really get involved in the tactical side of stuff. Possibly because he came from a background of a different sport, but also it would vary because he would take his parts that would be kind of advised by the coaches, as it were. So we'd say, you know, we'd like you to warm the players up by doing X, Y, Z. And then he would write his own session plan for that part of the session.
Okay, that makes sense, because he was coming from a different background. The reason I mentioned that is because a lot of the guys who I brought on have worked at the higher levels, and many of them have their, you know, coaching licenses, have coached themselves. Yeah. So it has I think they have a little bit more of a closer relationship, perhaps.
Without a doubt. So someone like Manuel Lapuente will have a much bigger impact tactically on the training ground. No question. But again, that will come because you're higher up in the game, and your resource will perhaps allow you to hire somebody with that experience. But I also think it's so important that coaches understand, you know, that as much as they can, the physical side of football in terms of the players' bodies. But I agree, fitness coaches need to understand football, and periodization and tactical periodization, in my opinion.
Now, we're talking about injury prevention, and obviously you're with Bromley initially, you're just seeing them Tuesdays and Thursdays. So how would you go about perhaps prescribing them extra work outside of those Tuesday, Thursdays, maybe if they had any time, in order to, you know, work on specific weaknesses to help prevent injury?
Well, they would be allowed to, if they needed to do extra work, they would be allowed to come in and train with one of the coaches within the academy, as one of the staff did. So he worked within the academy as well as the first team. So the players could go in and train with the academy to get their extra bits. Away from there, though, the only real work that they were given would be strengthening exercises, or injury prevention exercises, and that would come from the fitness coach, as that was his area of expertise.
Would Bromley talk about the importance of sleep and nutrition? I know that's a little bit of a fitness aspect.
Yeah, listen, 100%. So we always believe that, you know, to find the extra percents that don't cost a lot of money contribute massively. So even like making sure the players were fed properly. Certainly post-match, we ensure that they all had their recovery shakes and they had what we believe were the correct sports drinks for before, during and after games. And it became vital. Then when we became full-time, as it were, going into this season, the players, you know, there was always food laid on for players after training. In fact, to be fair, last season, as well, after training, there was always food for the players as well, which was designed by the fitness sports science coach. So massively important. And the players all kind of understood it anyway, because some of them have played at a higher level of football and many of them are personal trainers, and they understand it anyway and the benefits of it. I've worked at a team many years ago where I brought in a guy just to sort of test the players to see how hydrated they were. And he did it 3 hours before kickoff. And it turned out that from the starting 11, that the majority of them were quite dehydrated, and it would have been the equivalent of playing with 8 or 9 players to start the game. So, and it gave the team like a big wow, really. And so they started to take the hydration really seriously. Then that was a much lower level of semi-professional football. So if you can add in those small things, I mean, one of the things that, you know, that's my pet hates, and are these so-called fizzy energy drinks that are well marketed throughout the world. And you walk into a changing room and you see a player holding a can of Red Bull, for example. Obviously, other types of energy drink are available that are quite similar. And they don't understand that that's not going to aid the performance. So you do educate players in terms of their hydration, and the majority, and certainly the higher up you go, where they all will, they'll take it very seriously, because it does have an impact on their performance, and they understand that.
And I'm really glad that you're highlighting that, because I think sometimes nutrition and sleep get overlooked, especially I know here at the high school level, sometimes at the college level, it gets overlooked.
Sleep's hugely key, yeah. Massively key, you know, and also alcohol intake. You know that your players are going to want to have a night out, and so that needs to be planned in where there's no midweek game, you know, or there isn't a really heavy schedule coming up. You know, of very difficult games, but sleep is massively key. And you know, we try, if players can't sleep, we try to give them tips on how they can sleep better.
The other aspect that I think it will be important to mention here is, how would you go about creating a winning mindset at Bromley? You know, how did you go in there from day one that you took over to make sure that the players, you know, they knew that you understood them and were going to help them and nurture them and bring them up as make them better players ultimately. But how did you instill like that mindset?
What actually happened was, really, I mean, the mindset for me was set from the day I joined the club, where the actual manager, I wasn't the manager, James. I was one of the coaches. But the manager, he telephoned me, we'd met several times, and he said to me, would I go in and join the coaching staff, because he wanted to win the league, whereas up until that moment the club had always struggled at the other end of the table and had been in numerous relegation battles but had survived. And so from the moment that he phoned me, that to me was the mindset. And you know, we started that season like a train, and we, at one point, we were actually 13 points clear at the top of the table, but the team in second did have a lot of games, catch-up games, and they also had a larger resource financially to back them. And unfortunately for us, we got into March, sort of mid-February into March. We didn't have the depth of quality player within the match day squad to win the league. But we finished third, which was the highest the club's ever finished. And then we recruited very well in the summer, because the goal was to win the league. We were never going to shout from the rooftops, we want to win the league. But within our four walls, we did. And so from day one, we always spoke little things like about being champions. You know, like, so champions don't lose 2 games in a row, for example. That sort of mindset. And We were doing very well, and it got into January of this year. We had a cup game away against a team in the league above us, and we didn't have the strength again within the squad due to some injuries or suspensions, and we got beaten 4-0. And it was a long journey home. We're talking of a 5-hour bus journey home on a Saturday night. But as a coaching staff, we sat in our part of the bus, and we're just honest with each other. We thought we can't win the league like as we are. We identified some areas that we felt we need to improve, and the players that we felt we needed. And to be massive credit to the manager, he went and got 3 very, very important players. Who, when you sign these players, is a case of come and join us. We we're going to win the league. And so players will join. So the mindset was always very quietly, we want to win the league. And just, I think our preparation for the game in terms of how we approached every single game, we always, as a staff and as a group of players, we always thought, spoke and acted as though we were going to be champions.
Make a bit of a transition now. Part of this podcast is to give back to younger coaches, starting out their career. What recommendations would you have for them?
Don't get above your station too early. You know, start right at the bottom. I did, you know, go and coach children. Take your time doing your coaching badges and your licenses. Go and make mistakes and don't be afraid to make your mistakes. And that applies even to more experienced coaches as well. You know, to reflect on your own performance, what could you do better and why? You know, what would you change in the session? And did you change? And if not, why didn't you? Would you change it next time? So, for example, if an area is too small at the time, don't be afraid just to make it bigger. The players won't mind. Or even ask the players, do you think you should make it bigger? And if they say yes, then let them make it. Certainly with children, let them make it as big as they want it. I also think it's massively important to educate yourself, not just on your courses and licenses and badges, but you know, read books, arrange club visits, ask questions, spend time with people that are more experienced than you. But you know, most importantly, ask questions, because if you ask a coach a question about something, I guarantee you 9.9 times out of 10, they'll answer the question honestly. So that in a nutshell is what I would advise. But you know, especially don't be afraid to make mistakes and take your time.
Do you have any particular resources that are perhaps in books or websites or people that you follow that you feel would be beneficial for people starting out their career?
One thing that I always thought when I started coaching was that I bought loads of coaching books, right, that had loads of diagrams in them and X's and O's. And just looking back on it, I didn't have a clue what it meant. Do you know what I mean? So I'd perhaps try and avoid that to an extent. You know, there's a great resource in Twitter. There's a Twitter account called the Coaching Family that's got something like 30,000 coaches following them. And if you've got a question, they'll retweet it and someone will answer you. But in terms of other books, I always found it interesting to read books by managers, you know, because they'll talk about their own tips of the trade and how they dealt with situations. Because one thing that coaching courses can't teach you, or reading books, is what the game will throw at you. You know, so I sometimes something happens and I say, "Cor, just when I thought I'd seen everything in football, this comes along." You know, an incredibly bizarre scenario, and you're not taught how to deal with that on a coaching course. But quite often, in managers' autobiographies or well-known coaches' autobiographies, they'll talk about scenarios, situations, and how they dealt with it, and some of them are quite unconventional. But I think just being prepared to be a student of the game, regardless of whether you've played the game or not, I think it's the same with anything in life. You need to be able to move with the game and understand it and study it. And by studying the game, that might be listening to, you know, another coach speaking for 20 or 30 minutes, or, you know, listening to your podcast, James. You know, from guys that are, you know, people like Manuel Lapuente, who's top of his game. You know, you'll learn so much from somebody like him. And I believe he speaks in a way that's quite easy for less experienced coaches to understand. So I think it's just having the willingness to learn, to be a successful football coach at whatever level you're at. You know, you need to dedicate yourself to it. And those that do, and that's with any walk of life, are often the most successful.
Absolutely. Hugo, I just want to say thank you for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it, and have a great day.
James, thank you very much for having me on. I've enjoyed every single minute of it.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. If you have any questions or comments for Hugo Langton, please reach out to him. You can get his information on my website, www.historicperformance.net. I'm going to have his website, his email, and his Twitter account. So that's the best way to reach him. As always, I greatly appreciate the support that all of you listeners give. As I mentioned in the introduction, starting this week, you're going to have the opportunity to ask questions to upcoming guests. So I hope you take advantage of that, and I'll see you next time.